Welcome to Inside Ivy Hoops. Mike Tony here, joined by IHO writer extraordinaire Rob Brown. A bit of a hiatus for us throughout the season, but we've got the bandwidth to record and get this off now in this thick of things here. It's tournament time. We're here. We're glad you are too. And Rob, you were at the Ivy League tournament, Ivy Madness. How are you doing? You fully recovered?
I am mostly fully recovered. Yes, absolutely. thanks, Mike. It's great to be back. I know we bookended the start of the conference play, and now with the wrap up. But yeah, a really great event. But I feel good. Kind of a crazy feeling to be back. It was great, first time in 3 years, but certainly nerve-wracking. I'm not one of those people that's like ready to rip off my mask and like, you know, just jump right in. So being surrounded by a lot of people like that was certainly an interesting feeling. So I have recovered. I'll check with you in 2 weeks and let you know the full answer to that. But for right now, I feel good.
Yeah, you bring up a great point. We're still in a pandemic. We were now 3 years removed from the last Ivy League tournament. Of course, last season that wasn't preceded by the abrupt cancellation just prior to the 2020 Ivy League tournament that would have been. So, yes, a 2 year deferred tournament at Leviades, and of course the tough on the Harvard men, not even qualifying for the tournament, the Harvard women getting in, and Kathy Delaney Smith's swan song. Obviously we know what happened. Princeton, number one seed on both sides, didn't quite get it done on the men's side, and that's why they're locked in a tight battle in the NIT as we record this at VCU in the second half there as I speak. Maybe they pull it out. You'll know the answer by the time this is posted. But on the women's side, clearly the Tigers are the class of the league, taking care of business in the final against Columbia after a surprisingly close shave against an upstart Harvard team, playing with nothing to lose at home in the semifinal. I have to say, and we talked about this before recording, it came off great on TV, more so than in the first two seasons when it was at the Palestra. The Ivy League tournament really popped in terms of the visual of being a relatively packed crowd at Leviades, and the sound it was loud. It wasn't dead or cavernous like the Palestra was when it hosted the Ivy League tournament in the past. It was more akin and frankly surpassed in intensity through the TV set what it was at Lee Amphitheater back in 2019. So what was it like in person, Rob?
Interesting points. I think it was great in person. It was my first time at the Pavilion, and I was struck by how intimate it was, how warm it was. No, it's been renovated just a few years ago, but it's really clean, modern, climate controlled, especially when you think about like the older arenas in the conference. But the fans are really close to the action. There's really no bad seat there, so everybody really felt a part of it. And I think the players and the coaches, many of them made comments that it was hard to hear each other on the court. It was hard to hear each other in the huddle. They really liked the atmosphere. It was a real big positive to them. And I think for all of us covering, it was the same way. Right. So the number's not necessarily the most, the largest numbers imaginable. yes, you're right. More of the arena was filled out than previous years, and that really comes through when you're there. I do remember the early rounds of the Palestra, you know, when Penn played Princeton that first time in 2017. That was probably the exception where there was a loud crowd and it had a larger percentage filled. But, you know, I think your point really well taken is when it wasn't Penn, it was very, very quiet and very empty. And I don't think any of the six games felt that way this year. And I think also when you look at the women's side, I thought the crowd was larger in number, certainly in percentage of filling the arena, but also the intensity of the crowd was much more than previous years. So as someone in there, and especially someone who was able to cover it and didn't have to pay the ticket price, you know, it's certainly a very, you know, very positive experience. You know, I think that people were, again, the fans were very excited and happy to be there. You know, from a cost benefit, once you weigh in the factor of the price, some people may have a difference of opinion, but, you know, a very positive experience there. It'll be interesting to see where we go forward next year. It's obviously Jadwin. That is going to be a well-attended event. Then we start getting into some worrisome areas, Brown, Cornell, Dartmouth, Columbia, in terms of the types of venues we have, but also will those teams be in the tournament? And that's a question. And then, you know, for the people who live in Philadelphia, let's say, or Princeton, will they want to go up to Ithaca or Hanover? So there's some big questions after next year, but for right now, continues to be a positive, on at least on my side.
And why is TV important? Because it's all about branding, and we know that the Ivy League has emphasized, you know, wanting to present itself nicely for the tournament. It's a huge thing to have a conference tournament, whether or not old school Ivy fans agree with having one. It's certainly a recruitment tool in and of itself nowadays, and to have a product that you got fans there, you've got a situation that you can capitalize on and try to maximize the excitement factor as much as possible. And when you got a crowd that's into it, and you've got that kind of pressure cooker atmosphere, that comes through. That's more memorable. That does matter. I don't think it's academic or insignificant. So, you know, we'll see. We'll see if they ultimately do finish this tour of all the Ivy arenas that they've committed to.
Oh no, there was an interesting point. I think after the Harvard Princeton game, I think one of the reporters asked Kathy Delaney Smith if it should still be the men and women together, with the idea that the women's crowd for the women's games were larger and more boisterous and are growing every year, and you see that on a national level also. And I think, you know, she still feels there's a value in having everybody together. So I think that's a question that may also be discussed in the future, is do they make two separate tournaments? I know some coaches have talked with the idea of having all eight teams. Others want to keep it at four. But will the two groups stay together? I think the league wants to do that, and I think the majority of the coaches right now. But, let's see if things change that way as well.
Yeah, it's hard to see too far into the future, but one of the big controversies, of course, when an Ivy League tournament was conceived and announced, was the prospect of the number one seeds not getting in. And of course, what some Ivy onlookers called a potential travesty almost came to pass back in the very first Ivy League tournament, when fourth-seeded Penn at 6-8 nearly knocked off undefeated Princeton at the Palestra. Now, 5 years later, for the first time, a team that won a title outright did not win the Ivy League tournament. And of course, that now being Princeton on the men's side, finishing a game ahead of Yale, but losing to Yale. I think those two teams really fairly evenly matched. Not a huge upset. I don't think the Ivy League necessarily loses a whole lot of talent that it's putting forward in terms of putting their best team in the NCAA tournament. That probably was Princeton, but I don't think Yale is very much of a drop off. Clearly they would have an argument that there's none at all, since they beat Princeton 2 out of 3 times, and of course when the stakes were highest. But on the court at the Ivy League tournament, what stood out to you? What were the most memorable moments?
You know, the big moments. I thought the Cornell Princeton game was fabulous, right? Like that was probably the. I mean, all three games were good, but I thought that was the best, and you kind of knew that it was just set up that way. Yeah. You know, Mitch Henderson was not happy about it. Brian Erwin, they were not happy about having to play each other. So you could tell that there was, like, added drama. And then, you know, there was an emphasis from most of the coaches on the men's side that Cornell is just such a unique team. There's really no way to prepare for them compared to the other teams. So when we asked James Jones after the Penn game, you know, you got Princeton. He's like, well, yeah, we'll deal with them. Like, we've played them, we know them. But Cornell is that's a different, you know, a group of guys, and they play in a different style. So I just thought that had so much drama leading into it, and it just met, you know, every expectation. And, you know, just that last, I thought what was really kind of amazing was just the last 3 minutes where, you know, they had been out rebounding Princeton all game long, and then, you know, Princeton just gets 4 offensive rebounds, their first 4 of the day, and you can just tell there's a slip. The Ivy League teams are generally very close to each other, even when their records don't necessarily reflect it, and it's really just a couple differences in every game that show up, and that was a biggie just to see how they pulled that out. And Tosa Nwoman, I mean, just, you know, he's just such a great player. You know, Princeton just has so many talented players. Obviously, the outside shooting and Llewellyn's, you know, guard work, but Tosun is just like a really unique athlete. And, you know, Mitch Henderson pointed out that he said, you know, you really got to see this guy because there's really no, you're not going to see anyone like him in the next 25 years in this league. And as someone who really enjoyed seeing A.J. Broder, it's certainly understandable. You know, when you see these generational talents show up in the league, it's always worth the price of admission. So that was really big for me. I think a big thing for the Penn-Yale game was really seeing Jelani Williams. That was just an emotional thing to witness. You know, the difficulties he's had over those 4 years and the multiple knee surgeries, even when you stretch back to his senior year of high school. And then he has, you know, the hand injury against Yale midway through the conference season, and he gets 2 screws placed in his hand, and he's, you know, back 4 weeks later, and he's playing, and he's super intense. And you know, that was just, you know, there were just so many great moments. And Azar Swain, I mean, my gosh, give him an inch and he's going to find a 3-point shot. It's incredible. And, you know, when we talked to James Jones the day before the game, you know, how you defend Jordan Dingle, I said, well, the first game we just did, you know, man-to-man, and it obviously didn't work. But, you know, tomorrow we're going to put the entire team on him and the whole Penn team. And you could see, like, they were just hammering him, but somehow he still gets, you know, 28 points. That really stands out. Some other things that stood out, you know, I think that Harvard-Princeton game, I certainly, I don't know about you, but I was not expecting it. I kind of came in with that idea that Princeton's going to run away with 25, 30-point wins, and this is just going to kind of be a farce. Why do these teams, you know, why do they have to risk injury an upset or any, well, I wasn't even thinking an upset, but the way Harvard played them, like you said, they had nothing to lose. It was obviously Kathy Delaney Smith, potentially her last game. The emotions were high. They just, you know, this is a team that's 5 guards. They don't have a forward, and they were just crashing the boards, and they were hitting shots that had no business going in. And they really made it a one-possession game at the very end, and it didn't look like they got the shot they wanted, and Julia Cunningham tipped Mackenzie Forbes' 3-pointer with just half a minute to go. emotional ending for that. And, you know, then to just see the Columbia team, I think there were people that had some doubts. This was their first time in the tournament. They had two close games against Yale, and they just wanted everybody to know that they belong there. And so it was really impressive to see them just jump right out of the gate, which is something they hadn't done throughout most of the conference season. So that was another big moment. And, you know, that final on Sunday, just when it looked like, in some ways it looked like Princeton had a lot of energy taken out of them by that Cornell game. And I don't know if that was just physical issues or emotional issues on top of it, but they looked tired just a little bit. And you know, with Yale, as you said, they may have been a game behind in the standings, but they really are Princeton's equal. And I think the idea that if you give Yale an inch, that's an inch too much, and they just were able to take advantage and bang, you know, just had a great double-double, really solid. I was amazed that Princeton recovered and almost pulled it out at the end, but, you know, a testament to their talent, of course. But that was, there's just so many great individual moments and team moments that, you know, again, I could just ramble on about it, and I apologize, but just a lot of amazing storylines, a lot of great emotion. And I think, you know, the fan base for every team really showed up and added to it. So again, a lot of great stuff, just a lot of wonderful memories from those couple days.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, no need to apologize. If people don't want to hear from you, then they don't want to hear about Ivy League basketball. You know, looking at you know, the totality of the weekend, you of course got some access that most of us don't have, most Ivy fans don't have, you know, going to the press conferences, the post-game pressers, and kudos to the Ivy League for posting the videos of all of them so that anybody can go and see them. As a reporter myself, I appreciate the transparency, you know, getting that out there, just letting folks see what all the names had to say after the games. I know Megan Griffith kind of turned some heads with her, you know, typically blunt assessment of how her team did after going down against Princeton, just suggesting that her team is in fact on equal footing despite lacking some experience, and just didn't show up for most of that game. You know, on the men's side, some obviously memorable emotion from Mitch Henderson and really all the players, as you might expect. You get to see that raw emotion come through in the videos. You were there in person. What were your main takeaways from some of those exchanges, which I encourage Ivy fans to look up on the Ivy League YouTube page if they haven't already?
Yeah, I think you know, the great thing you see with these press conferences, and I wish there were more of them throughout the season. You know, as you were talking about Coach Griffith, her team, she and the Columbia group, women's group, they've been having weekly press conferences for the TV and press people, and it's really been helpful to kind of get an insight into the coach, to the team, and in the upcoming game. So as I wrote the other day, you know, the more teams that do this, the better. And again, with that idea of, you mentioned earlier about branding, you know, if you want to get the students more passionately involved, if you want to elevate the conference, you know, there's a lot of great talent, there's a lot of great coaches. Share it, you know, let us know, let us have more information rather than less, and you know, I think that's a big overriding idea for me. With the individual press conferences, you know, I thought from the men's side, it was really, again, that Princeton-Cornell, you could see the affection that Mitch Henderson has for for Brian Earl, but also for his players. It just felt like there were a number of times, even, you know, the opening Friday press conference, the way he was talking about his players seemed like he was very on the verge of tearing up, maybe, but he was certainly getting emotional talking about them. And he brought up that idea about Tosin Uwomahn, that you're not going to, like no one had asked him, and so he made sure that he got that out there, that you've got to see this guy play. And I thought another really important thing that he said was that Brian Earl and Cornell are the best-kept secret in the East, and I totally agree with that. I think Brian Earl is a spectacular coach. He always exceeds expectations. I just get the feeling it's really hard to recruit up in Ithaca for a whole host of reasons, whether it's resources, location. But boy, that guy always, you know, does such a great job with his teams. And you know, I think this year he was a well-deserved recipient of Coach of the Year because he took a group that was picked seventh and a group that didn't have many returning minutes. And, you know, he threw 13 guys out or 12 guys out a night, and it was just, you know, phenomenal to see how well they did. And I guess my worry as an Ivy fan is that someone's going to find out about that secret and try and peel him away. So I hope, you know, it remains a little bit of a secret from a selfish standpoint. So that was an important thing to watch. You know, you could see, I think, you know, Steve Donohue talking about Jelani Williams you know, came through, the emotions there. And I think also, you know, a team like Penn really, again, like, maybe, you know, I thought they might come in fifth this year, and they certainly had a rough non-conference schedule, but in some ways I think they exceeded expectations, and, you know, I think when you're given the injuries they had, and I think that came through in his conversation about how well they did this year dealing with their adversity and maybe the relative inexperience, and how, you know, after Saturday's loss, it's like, you know, I asked him about the future, and I think, you know, he feels very positive about it. I like that they're really close to not just being an Ivy League title team, but also a team that can make noise on the national stage. And I think Mitch Henderson echoed that about this year's team, but I think for Steve, it was next year's team. You know, from Yale, I, you know, as I wrote, it's like, this is a team that, you know, they've been there before, and James Jones carries himself in that way as a coach who has certainly been on the national stage for several years, and so that really comes across of his professionalism, his confidence. You know, just you know, we know the task at hand, and we're going to get this done. On the women's side, I think, you know, Kathy Delaney Smith, it's going to be a big loss. It is a big loss now that she's no longer the head coach of Harvard. Just funny, always. She gave a very nice introductory comment, and then the people from the league were like, we couldn't get the audio, and she was like, geez, I got to do this all again, you know? So she always has funny things to say and very insightful things to say about the game of basketball, but also gender equity, and I think that is always appreciated by everybody in the room. Allison Guth from Yale, super positive, you know, enthusiastic, super supportive of her players. And I think Carla Berube, you know, just, it's the first time I've ever seen her, and just, again, a genuine warmth and, you know, with her players, and a real strong connection. And I think you may have started it out about Coach Griffith, and I think she is a unique personality within the league, maybe especially since Courtney Banghart left. She knows she is a confident and assertive and demanding person and coach, and I think her players know that. And I think as a result, she gets the athletes that, you know, there's no surprise when you're coming to her program, just like the same with Courtney Banghart. You're the kind of player that wants that kind of coach who's going to fight with you, or fight for you, I should say, every step of the way, and really is going to help elevate your personal game and your team game. And you can see, I mean, this was a team that a few years ago was basically give the ball to Camille Zimmerman and let her do her thing, and now it is an absolute team, and they're 12-2 in the league and came in second place in the regular season and in the conference tournament. So the numbers are there, and they speak for themselves. And so it's a lot of you know, interesting personalities. And so I like you, I recommend people go see all of those press conferences. None of them are too long, but there's a lot of great insight you get really on the individual programs, and you see the subtle differences between them, and sometimes you can kind of see how that plays out on the court.
You mentioned it is interesting looking at the matchups. Cornell just seems to give Princeton fits every time they go up against each other. That's a great matchup. But it's not that way with Penn. You know, Penn seems to have its way with Cornell. Just a totally different feel. And of course, you can flip that on its head. Penn can't handle Princeton, which red and blue fans know all too well. You know, it's just sometimes matchups, you know, extend that way through multiple seasons, as is the case with those teams. And that's what I want to look ahead to now, looking at matchups, postseason matchups. Yale, back in the big dance, is going up against Purdue. Purdue, the number 3 seed, up in Milwaukee. It's a fascinating game there. You know, we'll see how it shakes out, but it's definitely a formidable matchup. Purdue with the 3rd ranked offense in the nation in adjusted offensive efficiency per KenPom. They have great shot selection. They are the 4th best 3-point shooting team in the country. Just a very, very efficient squad. You know, it's gonna be tough for Yale. Of course, Yale is coming off a game in which it you know, against Princeton, played another top 10 3-point shooting team in the country in the Tigers, but the Tigers did not look like that, did not play like that, and missed a lot of open looks that, frankly, if they give them to Purdue, you know, you're asking for trouble. And the thing that concerns me most with Yale in this matchup is just, you know, I think back to the game against LSU when Mione just went cold from the field in that game until it was too late. Just could not get in any sort of rhythm despite getting open looks. You know, Purdue is probably going to key in on Azar Swain. I think they will do their homework, and they're going to try to make things difficult for Swain in the early going, and it's going to be incumbent upon the rest of the Bulldogs and their complimentary scores to step up, just as they did against Princeton in the Ivy League tournament final. You mentioned you know, Bezen Beng stepping up, and you know, Yale just seemed to get what it needed when it wasn't getting it from Swain in the first half in particular to build that lead that it enjoyed throughout the game and hung on to at the end. That, I think, to stick with Purdue in the early going, they're going to have to replicate that. They're going to have to get something from somebody other than Azar Swain and just do their best on the perimeter to force Purdue off the 3-point line and just be as aggressive as possible. Yale has been very good at speeding teams up defensively, and they've actually excelled at defending the 3-point line, and you know, that will serve them well if they can pull that off against the best, one of the best in the country at that. Anything you're looking for in that matchup? What do you look forward to?
Yeah, I think you're pointing out the main things. Of course, I mean, absolutely. That you know, when you look at it, it's, in a way, it's strength against strength at the 3-point line. But Purdue will be more rested than Princeton when you compare it to Sunday's game. Yeah, is our swing going to... Well, I think the front court's going to really have their hands full. You know, Noling and Jarvis and Isaiah Kelly, they just haven't seen this kind of size before. You know, Purdue brings probably one of the biggest front courts in the country, especially, you know, I think that's going to be a really tough matchup for them. So they're going to be spending a lot of time and energy dealing with them on the defensive end. So I don't know how much offense you're going to get from those guys. From the three-point line, yeah, I think you're right. They're going to key on Swain, which I think makes it really important for Matthew Cotton to kind of step up. You know, he's been coming off the bench the last few weeks, but he certainly has the potential to hit from three. But it's definitely a tall order against those guys. And, you know, Yale doesn't really have, I mean, maybe for Yale standards, it has a deeper bench because they do play, they generally play like seven guys. But, you know, if they get in any foul trouble, you know, especially the guys in the front court, it's going to be a really tough match. I don't know if this was Yale's year, but it certainly, the matchup was going to be a really important factor. And I just don't think Purdue's a good matchup for them. And so I'm not optimistic. I think they'll certainly acquit themselves well. They always do. And the coaching staff will have them prepared. But it is a tall order to face Purdue, that's for sure. And then not too far from campus in Milwaukee. So it's not a home game, but it's not too far for them either.
Well, hopefully they keep up the tradition of Ivy League teams giving opponents all they can handle in the first round. You know, Yale did that against LSU, Princeton against Notre Dame. Of course, Yale upsetting Baylor back in 2016, and Harvard against North Carolina before that. Really, the only matchup where the game didn't come down to the wire was Penn in the ones in a ridiculously underseeded 1-16 matchup with Kansas. You know, that really made things extra tough on Penn that year, I think, 2018. But yeah, we'll see. I mean, Purdue is one of the lengthiest, tallest teams in the country. So, you know, Yale trying to maybe stretch them out, try to get out in transition, perhaps.
Right, I mean, they have a 7'4", ID is 7'4", and Williams is 6'10". I mean, that's a big front court.
Yeah, it doesn't get bigger than that. Sticking on the men's side, of course, you know, as we tape this, Princeton is struggling mightily. Looks like they're going to go down. You know, tremendous season from the Tigers. You know, I wanted to switch to the women's side and just take a look at that seeding. The 24th ranked team in the country gets an 11 seed. The math behind that does not make one iota of sense. Princeton again matched up with Kentucky, the team that they faced in their last appearance in the Big Dance back in 2019 in Courtney Banghart's final game at the helm. So Courtney Banghart and Carl Berube will get the same team to try to beat in the NCAA tournament in their last and first appearances in the tournament, respectively, for the Tigers. What are your thoughts on that seeding? I guess it's not surprising when you think back to them getting that 8th seed after an undefeated regular season in 2015. Thoughts on where they wound up and what's ahead for them?
Yeah, I mean, right. There were some, when you looked at the different bracketologies, they were 10. Some people may have had them like, you know, a 9. Certainly at the tournament, you know, a lot of the reporters were looking at them maybe being in an 8-9 matchup. But they obviously get an 11. I guess on the positive side, Florida Gulf Coast, another top 25 mid-major that Princeton beat. Cavaliers here on the road, they got a, you know, one slot lower at number 12. So at least it was fair. You know, like, even if it was unfair in the big picture, at least Florida Gulf Coast didn't score higher. Yeah, you know, it was something that the Columbia SID had mentioned throughout the last couple of weeks. When you look at the NET rating, the women and men are judged on it. They don't use it the same way. And I think they had looked at if Columbia women had the same, if they used the men's methodology, they would have been, you know, a much higher, they would have definitely been a tournament team, but it's not really done the same in the women's division. And unfortunately, it's kind of left it into that that older idea that if you're a mid-major, you really have to play top 25 teams, high major teams, and you have to beat them, which is sounds logical, but then if you're a good team like Princeton or Columbia, who wants to play you? Like, good luck. I mean, you know, to Vic Schaefer's credit in Texas, you know, they came to Jadwin Gym and played Princeton, and I guess they'll have the second half of the home-and-home last year. I mean, next year. But but many teams aren't going to take that chance. So it's very hard for the Princetons of the country to, you know, get themselves a higher seed. Who wants to play them? So I think, you know, from what Coach Griffith said at this week's press conference, you know, this is the system. You know, it is totally unfair. So she was not surprised that they were, you know, not seeded as highly as they should. She also, I think, a few weeks ago took issue with the fact that they didn't get their top 25 ranking until the very end of the season, you know, which kind of is a slight to the Princeton team and the league in general, that they weren't rated. You know, they certainly deserve to be a top 25 much earlier in the season. So now with that said, it's like you turn to the actual game, and I think my first thought when I saw the brackets come out, I don't know if you felt this way, I thought back to the 94 Penn and Nebraska on the men's side. That was a Nebraska team that was good, but they had a much better Big 8 tournament than their regular season had showed. So they ran through beating like Oklahoma and I can't remember who else, maybe it was Missouri, but they ended up winning the title, and so they kind of got a little bit of an overseed. And then Penn, which was undefeated, they ended up getting a lower seed with that same idea of being a mid-major Ivy League school, so they got underseeded. And so you had, you know, things set up with two teams that were probably much closer in reality than they were based on their seedings, and Penn ran away with that game. So I don't expect Princeton to run away necessarily, but I do think that the distance between Princeton and Kentucky is a lot closer than their actual seeding. Statistically, when you look at the numbers, I mean, it's another game of strength versus strength. Princeton's defense is absolutely one of the nation's best. You know, you were saying about Purdue a few moments ago, but, you know, Princeton's defense is top 10 in the country on a number of metrics. Effective field goal percentage, they're number 9. Points per play, they're number 3. Field goal percentage, number 7. Their rebounding is, I think their offensive rebounding, they're 28th in the country. Defensive, 44. Ellie Mitchell can certainly battle anybody in the country in rebounds, so that shouldn't be a problem. Kentucky is just a really good offensive team. They are top 50 to top 100 in two-pointers, three-pointers. So it's a strength versus strength, but if you kind of look at the numbers, Princeton's defense is stronger than Kentucky's offense. So I certainly give them a really good chance. And I think one thing I didn't mention when you asked about the tournament, probably the biggest, one of the biggest positives I thought was watching Caitlin Chen play. I mean, if you haven't seen her, I know Princeton fans knew about her throughout the season, and, you know, some Ivy League fans knew about her, but when you started seeing that Columbia game on national TV a few weeks ago, where they basically dared her to beat them, and she did in the first quarter, she just took it to another level in the tournament. She scored 30 points in the final game and was the most outstanding player. So, you know, Abby Myers is going to be there offensively, and Ellie Mitchell defensively, and, you know, for rebounding, the entire Princeton team will be there in team defense, but Caitlin Chen is certainly an X factor on offense. My biggest concern, I guess, with Princeton is their depth, and they are one of those teams that really plays Well, they do have six people in their rotation, but they get a lot of mileage out of the top five. So if Kentucky can wear them down, get them into foul trouble, that becomes a different situation, because once they start going to the bench, you get a little bit of a drop off, or and it's probably significant enough that it could turn the tide in a close game. So that's my big worry. If they stay out of foul trouble and that top five shows up, then they certainly have a definite chance at the upset.
And should be noted that Courtney Banghart is in the tournament, leading North Carolina to a 5 seed in the big dance. So good luck to her. I know that on the men's side, there's the Iowa Richmond Fran McCaffrey against Chris Mooney matchup. Selection committee decided to put a little Penn Princeton flavor in there. One of them has to win, one of them has to lose, I guess. It's a double-edged sword, but what are you going to do?
I'm biased towards the Penn side, but also I've been a big Iowa fan since the Ronnie Lester days in the late 70s and Lute Olson before he went to Iowa. So, yeah, I loved Dr. Tom Davis when he was there. So it's Iowa's one of those really great programs decades.
And they just showed Yale how to beat Purdue, so maybe James Jones can call up Coach McCaffrey and get a tip or two. Sticking on the women's side, Columbia accepted its automatic bid in the WNIT against drawing Holy Cross. Faced the Crusaders for the first time, that game at Levian Gym Wednesday night at 7 o'clock. That game will be on Sportsnet New York in the New York market. A great opportunity for Columbia folks to get out and see their team. It's reminiscent of the Columbia men's CIT run back in 2016 to close out the Kyle Smith era with Matt Arlow and Alex Rosenberg, that crew. It's anytime you can get postseason games at home. Again, that was 6 years ago. These opportunities don't come around very often. They come around less often, really, all the other Ivies in terms of getting postseason tournament games at home, outside of the Ivy League. So, big opportunity there for Columbia fans. I know tickets can be bought ahead of time at the ticket window. So hopefully there's a strong safe turnout there in that matchup. Anything you're looking for in that game, or
I like your safe comment idea. It makes me think of that what was it, Bryant against Wagner. Glad to see that didn't happen at the Ivy tournament. That was a mess. I think if you look at the big picture with Columbia, and I think you see this idea, and the coach has mentioned it, is, again, with her 6 years being an assistant at Princeton, it's trying to create that same Princeton-like culture at Columbia. And that's certainly a challenge when the student body isn't as sports-oriented at a lot of the Ivy League schools as it was in decades past. But they've done a really great job, especially once they've the COVID numbers came down and students and fans could come back to Levian. They've done a really great job at getting students excited, to get students into the arena. And I think this is just another part of that step, is that, in these WNIT games or the CIT, as you were mentioning, the schools have to pay for those, right? Those are not games that are just like, okay, they're going to choose one gym over the other. other, and the school and the athletic department and the administration has to get behind this, the team for that. And so I think it's really a testament of the effort that they've put in this year that the school is sticking behind them and encouraging them and promoting them. And I think, you know, if you are you know, a student on campus, it's really a great thing to get out there and support them and get there and go to the game. And I think they are looking at it like, you know, I think they said today, you know, no Ivy League team has gone beyond the second round of the WNIT. And I think that's a goal that they have, is to keep moving forward. You know, half of the teams they said that were in last year's WNIT are now in the NCAA tournament. So this is a great, you know, development, a period of development where they can learn more about postseason play and, you know, kind of get ready to take that next step, you know, whether it's as an automatic qualifier, maybe in the future as an at-large bid as well, you know, to the old two-bid Ivy scenario. I think things look good for them against the Crusaders. Crusaders, I always think like Howard Cosell should be announcing that, the Crusaders. but, you know, another really good defensive team, but I think the difference is that Columbia's offense is better than Holy Cross's offense. So, you know, I think that's going to be a win in Columbia's column come Wednesday night, but, you know, we'll see what happens, but I think it's a favorable matchup for them. Holy Cross, like, focuses a lot of their attention on one player in particular. That is Avery LaBarbera, who, like, leads them in points and rebounding. But, you know, I think Columbia has more of a team approach. That's been what's their strength this whole year, is they just keep sending player after player out there. And I think that will certainly wear down Holy Cross. So I do think that, you know, there will be at least one Ivy League team that goes beyond the first round in these tournaments.
Columbia would certainly seem to be the favorite there. Any other thoughts on how these conference tournaments shook out for the Ivy League this year, either from the Ivy League tournament perspective or looking ahead to these still outstanding postseason tilts? I mean, there's a lot of talent in the Ivy League. That's for sure.
I mean, I think it was Joe Lenardi who was doing his bracketology breakdown of each team this week, and, you know, I think it was him, and, you know, just talking about the idea that the Ivy League made, you know, they're back, and how, you know, and I think the quality of play was much better than people had expected, and you know, I think these athletes really deserve a tremendous amount of credit. You know, they put their lives and their career on hold for a year. That's a lot to ask for these student athletes. And I think, you know, when you think back of practices starting in October, and you think, you know, now we're in March, and, you know, just the emotional ups and downs when you look at, like, the case rates going down and then going up, and you know, some of the teams made it through. Like, I know Mitch Henderson pointed out the idea that they didn't end up testing positive for their team, and, you know, just how incredible it was. But just the amount of emotional energy and physical energy that these teams went through to get through this season, I think that is something that we fail to appreciate, and sometimes I do as well, because I get caught up in the individual games. But this is, every year is an emotional roller coaster over the 6 months, but this year was even more. And the fact that they made it through, and we had a full slate of conference games with just a couple little, you know, hiccups along the way, and the tournament went off without a hitch, and you got to see a lot of great basketball. I think it's just a testament to all the players, all the coaches, all the staff, the league office. You know, we certainly have our ups and downs and our moments where we may not agree, but, you know, I think we can all, with everybody, but I think we can all agree that they all did, you know, a tremendous job this year getting from the starting line to the finish line, and I'm just happy about that. I'm happy to see that Yale was playing in Princeton and the Princeton and Columbia women, and I just think it's a great testament to all of their effort. And yeah, I think it's just the reboot, and you know, we're going to see even better next year. I wish we could revisit the idea that these students who lost a year would have the option of sticking around their teams for one more year. You know, all the sophomores, juniors, and seniors. Maybe they'll revisit it. I don't know. I kind of doubt it. But, you know, wherever they end up going over the years, you know, we'll still follow them and root for them. But, you know, next year's Ivy League tournament and conference play should be even better this year, and I'm hoping it'll be a safer environment for all.
That's a great forward-looking, encouraging note to end on. Rob Brown, thank you so much for all the coverage and insight you give into all things Ivy Hoops for us at IHO, and let's enjoy this let's enjoy these last few games. We've been through a lot this season to get to them, so let's savor them while they're here.
Absolutely, thank you, Mike, and thank you for, you know, again, being our leader, our fearless leader, and giving us the best guidance imaginable.
You all make it pretty easy. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again real soon on Inside Ivy Hoops.